In this episode, we wait out there with John Easden from Colorado Springs, Colorado. John grew up in Colorado fishing with his father, who took him to a fly shop when he became fascinated with fly fishing as a boy. John has been fly fishing his entire life since then, and now guides in that same fly shop, Angler's Covey. There he continues to follow his passion on and off the water, welcoming new folks to the sport he loves. We discuss presentation while nymphing, the South Platte River, as well as fishing and tying midges. John also shares how finding sobriety saved his life and his relationship with the river, and why he truly believes there are no bad days in fly fishing. Welcome to the Wade Out There Fly Fishing Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Shemchuk. At Wade Out There, we believe fly fishing is special, but not elite, and that anyone can become a great fly fisher if they are willing to go, learn, and teach. Join me as I talk with other fly fishermen and women about their unique journeys into fly fishing, the rivers they fish, and the tactics and philosophies they practice. For those who can never leave the river in their hearts, this podcast is dedicated to helping you make the memories that keep us all coming back to Wade Out There. Welcome, John. Thanks for being on the Wade Out There podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here today.
I'm happy to have you here today. It's always a pleasure to talk to someone who's out in Colorado fishing some of the waters that I used to fish when I was a kid and younger. And I told you earlier before the show, I kind of went through the school of hard knocks on the South Platte when I really got into fly fishing. I didn't realize that at the time. It was just all I had available to me. But then I went and fished different places and learned more about fly fishing in different areas and even just tailwaters. And it started to come together like, well, maybe it was not just you being a terrible fly fisherman that led to like all those skunks and, you know, days on the river. But they were all good days. No bad days. I got to say that.
Yeah. No bad days on the water.
No bad days. But I'm excited to talk to you about Colorado, a little bit about the South Platte, and then getting into some of your flies and dead drifting techniques and things like that. But I want to know how you got started in fly fishing, and has it always been Colorado for you?
Yeah, so I had kind of a standard start to the whole game. I was born in Leadville, Colorado, and kind of grew up in, you know, outside hunting and fishing my whole life. From a very early age, I was connected to the outdoors. And I didn't fly fish back then, but, you know, you cannot take away the experience throwing little Castmasters in beaver ponds.
Leadville, Colorado is a good start.
Yeah,
that's a good place to start.
So
odds are good.
Yeah, exactly. so those are really near and dear memories to me being a little kid. And I do remember connecting to fishing and feeling the hook of the whole process. When I was about 12 years old, we moved to Woodland Park, which is a little town outside of Colorado Springs. And my father and I were fishing at 11 Mile Canyon, one of the more popular places on the South Platte. And I saw some guys fly fishing. And I distinctly remember watching them and going, wow, what is this? I hadn't seen it before. And my dad didn't have really anything good to say about fly fishers at that point.
What were some of the bad things he said? Let's hear those.
He said that, yeah, they're all a bunch of pretentious douchebags.
Okay. Yeah.
And so that kind of set the stage for my intro to fly fishing, because I wasn't a shy kid. And I'd walk up to those guys and ask them what they were doing and if they could show me. And, you know, largely it was met with, you know, get away from me, kid. What are
really?
You doing?
Okay.
Yeah. And I was really defeated. I do remember feeling really defeated. But my dad took me to this fly shop in Colorado Springs. And I went into this fly shop and asked these folks for help. And they were glad to see me. You know, they were very inviting and they kind of gave me a start. It's not like I blew up from there, but
yeah.
They made it inviting. And so I went in there and it's pretty cool because that's the same fly shop that I actually work for right now.
I was going to ask you, so what is that feeling like? Because
yeah,
now fly fishing is is a huge part of your life. I mean, it's your, you know, that's what you do for a living. And I mean, it's been a part of your journey in life. And now you've gotten to, I mean, you get to do that every day, right? There's always somebody that you can kind of give that different perspective to. And one of the things, like the tagline at Fly at Weight Out There is fly fishing is special, but not elite. And
yep, absolutely.
That is the, I think that that's cool. And I think that the opportunity to be able to kind of squash those prejudices or those preconceptions that people have is like a great opportunity. And I mean, I think there's a lot more people now than that are excited to see that kid in the fly shop than there aren't, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing. It's, I mean, what you're talking about are barriers, right? And anybody that's been around fly fishing for any amount of time realizes that there were a lot of barriers, you know, and it's come a long way in the last 15 years, even, you know, there's, it's more inclusive. And I think that's really a kind of a unified message that the fly fishing industry is taking is, we want ultimate inclusivity in the outdoors. And for me, it's not just fly fishing, right? It is the outdoors. Like, it doesn't really matter what you're choosing to do. And if you want to throw that Castmaster on as an adult and go to the beaver pond, man, high fives for you, right? Because it doesn't really matter. You're out there. That's the important thing. So, but that was really, again, it was instrumental to be invited into that circle. And then, you know, many, many years later, I've been blessed to know really good mentors in fly fishing, in the fly tying circle, in the fly fishing circle. And I really came into it right. And so for me, it's really part of what I do. Like, I like to give back. I want to be that. I live that whole deal with those barriers in fly fishing, and I want to crush those down. So everything I do in my classes and my guiding and everything, I really want to put those barriers to rest, and make it inviting for anybody to come in, no matter their age, their race, their sex, their ability. I mean, it is absolutely for everybody. And, you know, and that's really kind of one of the taglines of the shop of Angler's Covey is, inviting you into adventure. You know,
that's cool.
We like to say we don't sell fly rods. We sell the experience of fly fishing. So, everything we do is tailored to that exact concept.
That's really cool. You talk about barriers, and I would agree with everything you said. what kept you coming back when you start bumping up against that barrier of just the difficulty of it? Or how do you, so that's part one. And I guess part two, how would you overcome that? Or how do you look to overcome that in people that are new to the sport, like young people or folks? Because that can be intimidating as well. Like, I feel like you almost have to have this kind of expectation going into it, that maybe it's not going to be pulling them out of the water every couple minutes type of thing.
Yeah.
So maybe there's something else. So I guess, what kept you coming back, and then, you know, what techniques or what things have you found to help kind of overcome that, less, I guess, less altruistic barrier, perhaps more selfish, like, how do we catch fish here? This is a barrier.
Well, I think, fly fishing is such an interesting deal. And everybody that's ever held a fly rod, whether it's been once or a lot of times, can relate to this statement, but fly fishing always gives you just enough to keep you coming back. Right. So that's the thing. It's the wonderment of it. What I really enjoy about fly fishing in general is we absolutely geek out on what the fish are eating to a moment to moment basis and all their different life stages of these insects, and focusing on that, you cannot get bored. I have a lot of people, I teach some of our beginner classes, and one of the statements that I hear all the time is like, oh, I don't like fishing. It's boring. And their version of that is sitting in a lawn chair, you know, staring at a bobber in a lake. And yeah, that's boring. There's no way I could do that.
I'm the same way. Yeah. Even lake fishing. I know you love lake fishing, and I'd probably need to explore that a little bit, but yeah, to me, yeah. I like the moving around in the water, in the river and stuff, but yeah. Okay.
Well, and it's just, it's, we'll get to that, but yeah, it's just, you gotta, change your perspective of it.
Sure.
So the thing, and I see this a lot, you know, it's, you got to keep your head in the game. Surround yourself with people that have what you want, you know, find some people in your local fly shop or people that you have, you know, will even answer you on Instagram and be willing to help you with whatever you want. You know, I tell everybody I'm a wide open book, man. I get messages all the time from people asking about certain techniques and man, I want to share that knowledge with them. And then I want to see the follow through, you know, it's cool to do that. And then you see a picture with that smile and they actually completed the puzzle. So that's what it's all about. Once you complete one puzzle, it just keeps getting deeper and bigger. And I have seen really no end to that. And that's for me, the draw and the pull. I mean, I am never going to stop learning. And that's really the cool thing. If we mastered this, I mean, fly fishing wouldn't even be an industry.
Yeah. What was one of the hardest things to overcome when you were learning to fly fish? One of the things that you remember, like really an aha moment for you when you were starting out?
Well, and you alluded to it, you know, by talking about growing up on the South Platte River and, you know, it's no secret. The South Platte River is well known and it's no secret that it's very technical. And I think that's actually an attribute to anybody that grows up fishing rivers like that. You learn the technical side of fly fishing and the really important pieces of fly fishing. So I remember kind of my aha moment, and this happened quite a while ago, was I realized that my fly selection was probably secondary to my presentation. It just started to make more sense that was the case. And I think, you know, a lot of people spin their wheels in the fly fishing industry and, you know, anglers in general, like what fly, what size, like, is that important? Yeah, it's important. But growing up and fishing these super technical waters, I'm really more of the belief that it's my presentation. If I can get kind of close with the fly patterns, and that's, to be clear on that, that's size and silhouette for the most part. If I can get pretty close to that, and I put those bugs in the environment like they look like they belong there, then I'm naturally going to have success. So that was a pretty big aha moment. And I have these all the time, all these times throughout my life of fly fishing is this little voice pops up in my head and I say, man, you are massively overthinking this. It happens on the river. It happens at the vice. It happens all over fly fishing. So I think you know, a lot of times I had some tough days where nothing was working and I was beating my head against the wall and you get discouraged. And what I've learned to do from there is just go back to the basics and simplify. And that seems to be the recipe for success.
Well, let's talk about some of those things. Let's talk about dead drifting and specifically nymphing. I mean, obviously you can dry fly on those rivers or dry fly fish on those rivers. My experience has been when I started to understand nymphing better, I started to catch more fish on the South Platte. I mean, I just had more opportunities. And that was one of my aha moments was just coming from Montana and being a kid that only flew through dry flies. Cause that's the only box of flies that we found in the trapper's lodge. Like, you know,
yeah.
And so that was kind of my going into it notion and moved to Colorado and then started really figuring out, oh, nymphing is important and it's a great way to catch fish. When you think about dead drifting, what are some things that you find yourself overthinking?
Yeah. So, well, I think the statistic is that trout eat about 80% of their diet under the water. On the South Platte, it's probably closer to 90%. So the fact,
okay, that's what I was trying to get at. Yeah. I was like, dude, I mean, you could dry fly at that, like you could throw dries on that river and it's great, but
yeah, I mean, I had a guide trip the other day and, you know, we had a great session on top and fishing adult blue wing olives. So it's like one of those things, we just have to be ready for those opportunities when they present themselves. I fish year round. I fish all through deep winter and everything all over these spots on the South Platte and the Arkansas rivers. And that's where you can really learn a lot about fish behavior. So if you ever have the ability to watch a fish eat subsurface, they're very tactical about it. They will actually ignore natural food sources that are in different parts of the water column. They'll stay in one part of the water column, especially in the colder months, and they won't move much. So really the only food that they want to consume is the food that's going to go right to their face. And one of the things I like to think about is, especially, so this is kind of double-sided. I do a lot of straight line nymphing, so nymphing without an indicator, or what we call old school Euro nymphing.
Okay. I was going to ask you about that too, yeah. How that plays into your dead drift and reach and distance that you know, and angles and approach, but
yeah.
You do that mostly or the Euro or tight line or whatever?
Yeah. Straight line nymphing is probably my first and foremost. I mean, it's really hard to argue the effectiveness of static indicator nymphing. I mean, you can work just specific parts of the water column. The thing with straight lining or anything like that, Euro nymphing, is it can take a beating on your arm, trying to elevate and keep your flies in a certain zone. So, I mean, I'm not ever going to poo-poo like one aspect or type of fly fishing. I'm not going to say this is the best and this one you don't want to do. Ultimately, you have to do what works for you. I'm a big proponent in being well-versed in every single technique out there. So, if I see a location where, you know, Euro nymphing is definitely going to be the ticket, that's what I want to do. If a lot of times on the South Platte, particularly up in South Park, we get a lot of wind up there. And if you've tried to Euro nymph in wind, it doesn't work too well. So, that's a good time to throw on an indicator and keep a low line on everything and not have the wind drag my line and dictate where my drift is going. But one of the things I like to think about, and I'll just talk about this from the static indicator perspective first, is, you know, when you cast your flies out there and you're watching your indicator go down the river, a lot of the belief is you want that indicator to be going slightly slower than the river speed. And that indicates that my flies are down in the column and they're set. They're almost kind of dragging, the indicator along, right? It's going a little bit slower. I like to actually go beyond that. And I like to think about looking at my indicator from a bird's eye view. Now, laterally, if I cast out there and I'm matching that speed and everything, I could unknowingly be pulling that indicator towards me. So while the river speed or the speed of the drift looks good, actually the placement is off because it's being drugged towards me. So a lot of people can get stuck on that. They're like, man, it looks like I have a good drift. And that's where I'd say, you know, pick the seam in the river that you're fishing. I tell people this all the time, take a few leaves or, you know, a handful of grass off the bank and ball it up and throw it out in that seam and watch where the river wants to take it. That's your goal. That's where you want your indicator to be. That's your goal if you're Euro nymphing. That's your goal if you're straight lining. You want to hit that seam and be able to have your flies be delivered in the section of river where it wants to go. And that helps a lot of people. That's kind of a game changer, I think. And again, that really starts to highlight my presentation and where my flies are going to be the most important factor in that drift.
So when you're looking at the water and you throw the leaves or something like that, are you using that as a judge of like, okay, it should be slightly slower than that? Or, you know, because you're trying to target that bottom water. I think what I'm hearing you say is you want to target that cushion of water along the bottom that's moving slower and the fish hang out there and that's where they're feeding. So if I'm doing that, the fly, to what you originally said, is going a little bit slower, I guess. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So
the fly along the bottom is going slower. And so it's going to kind of hang up your whole kind of rig.
Yeah. And I'll answer that in two parts. So the whole thing with the the leaves or the grass is that's on the surface. I'm looking where that seam is on the surface. So that line that ball of grass takes down the river is where I want my indicator to kind of take that same line. If I'm casting it out there and it's coming, I'm starting in that seam, but I'm pulling out of it, that means I'm pulling my line. So you can do something very simple as such as when I get my flies where they need to be at the beginning of my cast, I can throw a stack mend and you watch everything correct and it goes exactly where it wants to. Now, to the second part of that, where I am in the water column is the other very important thing, right? Yeah, we're always trying to target that column of water near the bottom, that water that's barely moving, where fish, trout love to sit in. By nature, they're never going to expend more energy than they need to, so they're always going to sit in the easiest water available, unless the food productivity is so high that they can afford to expend a ton of energy eating that. So from that point, it's just about me getting the right depth, you know. I like to work in micro increments if I'm using a static indicator rig. If, you know, my indicator is going to tell me how far down my flies are going to go, and my weight is going to tell me how quick they get there. So I'm going to use both of those things to kind of determine, you know, where I need to be and how much weight and all that kind of stuff. It's all going to be based on the water speed and what I'm actually fishing.
You just brought up a very fond memory for me, so I appreciate that. My dad used to call what you're describing which way the stick floats. Uh-huh. And he used to take me out, and he would always grab a little stick and throw it. Mostly we're fishing pocket water a lot of the times and stuff, but he would say, you need to know which way the stick's floating, son. And he always says that, like he used to say that when I grew older as a teenager or something, and I would be going down the wrong road, you know. He's like, hey, man, you need to know which way the stick floats here to find the right way. So I appreciate that. I think that's a great technique that I probably don't do enough, especially for that lateral kind of seam and flow, because it's deceiving. You know, you can think that you have it dialed in, but maybe you don't. And that's a good technique. You mentioned something that I want to go back into, and that's drag. One of the reasons I think why Euro nymphing or straight line or tight line. Let me get this straight though. When you're saying straight line, are you saying that in the, like as in Euro nymphing or tight lining or straight lining, are you saying those are all kind of similar type of versus indicator, I guess would be the counter to the.
So first off, it'd be easier if I kind of talked about my general rig system first, and then it'll start to make a little more sense. So, I don't use tapered leaders nymphing. I use a butt section of like 12 pound amnesia. On the end of that, I tie a micro swivel. From that micro swivel, I just run straight fluorocarbon clear down.
So you go straight from the fly line to the amnesia? No maxima in there or anything?
No, just this is just, again, the beautiful thing about fly fishing is there's a million different ways to do this.
That's why I'm asking, man, because I'm trying to find my way, and I'm struggling. So I'm okay.
So I like amnesia a lot, especially nymphing. It gives me a little bit more rebound too. If I'm tight on a bigger fish and a smaller fly, I want every advantage that I could possibly have in that fight. You know, if you you've cooked a large fish on a size 22 or 24 fly, there's not much bite in there. On five,
it's very stressful. Yeah, it's stressful.
5 or 6x.
For me, it is.
Yeah.
Based on absolutely. My hook setting tactics, my hook setting abilities, it's always stressful.
Yeah. So, you could run just that amnesia to a micro swivel, or a lot of times I like to have, like, I have a little piece of amnesia here with a blood knot to a butt section and then to a micro swivel.
Okay.
And then what's cool about this is this gives me a platform here on that butt section to put my indicator. Now my indicator will only be on that butt section. And then, so I really have to be kind of close to, fishing kind of the same ish depths throughout the day or whatever. I can take off just a piece of fluorocarbon. The benefit of that and the benefit of being attached to that micro swivel is now my line instantly sinks. So there's less area for that to kind of drag sinking down, which you can get from a tapered leader, right? This just fluorocarbon just cuts through that water and it gets right down into the zone. So even by doing that, I've found that I have to use way less weight. So when I do fish water that has a lot of crap in it, like rocks and logs, a lot of structure, I find myself not hooking that stuff as much. So this allows me to, and I could just have a regular nymph rig. I could do two flies, you know, either eye to eye or eye to bend, however you wanted to really do that. I like to go eye to bend on my standard nymph rig. And then a good friend of mine, Brian, he only fishes this drop shot method, which I love to fish too. And that's more of a bottom weighted concept on the end of that system. So I would have, whatever section of or length of leader, which would just be fluorocarbon. And then on the very bottom, that's where I would tie a weighted fly. And then up from there, I would tie, tags or droppers, just a double surgeon's knot with 5X tippet or whatever at various places throughout that leader. You know, maybe 4 inches, 3-4 inches. And that's where I would tie on my other flies. The benefit of that, whether I have an indicator or I'm straight lining, is my flies are always going to be in the water column. That weighted fly is going to be near the bottom. That'll allow me to target different places in the water column too. So there's a lot of places where that's a perfect method. I love that method when you're fishing shelves or very quick drop-offs. The drop shot is the way to go with just that fluorocarbon leader system. It's going to drop down like a rock, and you're actually going to get those flies down to those fish very quickly. So by having this method, I could simply take the indicator off and I'm almost Euro nymphing at that point, right?
Where do you put the indicator? You put it right at the swivel?
Yeah, I'm going to put it in that butt section between the amnesia and the micro swivel. And that allows, I can have all kinds of different lengths here, but what that swivel allows it to do too, if you have really dynamic water, is if you have a fixed leader system, your flies are going to roll over. They're going to fold. With that micro swivel, if that river current's wanting to take them in all these funky places, it's going to keep your flies true.
That makes sense. So you've got the fly line going to your amnesia, going to a swivel to your fluorocarbon.
Yeah, or you can do it that way. Or what I like to do is, you know, maybe a foot section of amnesia, blood knot to a butt section that's maybe the same size, and then the micro swivel.
I got you. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And that's got to help with drag. What are some other things that you think about with drag and reducing drag? You've mentioned a lot of them, I guess. So if there's anything else that you could think of.
Well, it's the mend. The mend, I think, is a really important piece of this. I'm a huge proponent of a stack mend and doing a stack mend properly. It's a really hard thing to explain. I think I've gotten pretty close to try to explain this to folks, though. When you cast, whether, and we'll just go back to say we're fishing an indicator rig. When I cast, my flies hit, I'm going to slowly lift my rod tip up and I'm going to flick the rod tip right at my indicator. And the easiest analogy here is you're trying to flick cake batter off of a spoon. I don't know why that helps people, but it does. So as soon as my flies hit, I'm going to lift my rod tip slightly and I'm going to flick the cake batter off of the spoon. That throws any slack right at my indicator. That allows my indicator to find the seam of the river it wants to be in and then go down. That'll allow me to then go to a high stick and mitigate any other line that's closer to me and keep that from dictating where my drift goes. So having a good drag feed free drift is just super important. a stack mend is one of the best things you could ever learn to achieve that.
And you're keeping line off the water, which is,
yep,
is helping. I mean, that's something that, that even when I wasn't, straight line nymphing or Euro nymphing, that's something that I started to do when I needed to be really precise with my drift, or if I was fishing really tricky water that maybe it wasn't as important before, where I could have my fly line out there to an indicator on a tapered leader and be nymphing and catching fish. Like when, yeah, I really need to like, nug down on that, or when I really have to like get technical, that doesn't work so good. And that led me to not just keeping less line on the water or keeping more line off the water, but also to fishing closer to a lot of places. I wonder, yeah, if you can talk to kind of angles that you use to approach like different seams. Maybe you could, maybe some examples of like water type and how you would approach it and distance. And 'cause now we're, you know, we're getting closer to fish. That's also could be good, could be bad, right?
Yeah. And that's the thing. I think the thing I've heard is that most trout fishing is done within 25 feet of you. And I don't know why every angler I know, including myself, you know, you're walking up the river and the other side of the river looks really tasty. So you want to just blow through everything that's right at your feet and fish that water. But I always like to start close to me. And the easiest way to think about this, I like to think about you're holding a slice of pizza. So if I'm holding a slice of pizza right out in front of me, the tip of that slice that's close to me is very small. As it goes out into kind of a V shape, right? So I like to say wherever I'm standing in the river, I'm holding my piece of pizza, and at the edge of those, that crust of that pizza is where I want a perfect drift. I don't care what happens on either side of the crust. If I want to fish up or down from there, I will actually physically move my body. I'm not going to try to be lazy and stretch that out. By keeping it very contained like that and shorter, I'm going to have ultimate control over that drift. And I like to set the river up in a grid. So I have lateral lines and I have horizontal lines. So I have my piece of pizza. That's my V. I'm going to start close and I may throw, I don't know, X number of drifts, whatever I'm comfortable with there. And then I'm going to creep that out a few inches and do the same thing in a few inches and the same thing and repeat that until I'm at a point in the river where I don't have control over my drift anymore. At that point, I can actually...
pizza's gotten away from you. Like you, yeah, can't reach the river in the pizza. So now, yes, you're going to move, physically move your body to where now your pizza reaches a different area.
Yep. And I'm going to repeat that. So let's just pretend we have a run. We have a riffle that's coming into a run. There's a nice shelf, a drop off. So I'm going to work, maybe I'm working upstream. I'm going to start at the, you know, in the run section of that. And I'm going to do that to about the middle of the run, do that grid thing. And I'm going to move up the river 5 feet and I'm going to repeat that, starting close, ending in the middle. And then I'm going to move 5 feet up and repeat that. And then 5 feet up and repeat that. Now at the end of that, I'm going to go back to where I started and then walk into the river a little bit more where I can reach the further seams, and I'm going to start that grid all over and cover water that I hadn't hit.
I love this. That's great. That's a yeah, great,
it's nerdy.
It's a great methodical, methodical is the word. It's very methodical, yeah, but that's good. And my question with the pizza is you mentioned everything's kind of within 25 feet. So what are the dimensions of your pizza, I guess, because people have different ideas, but like what, I guess, what angle, coming off of your body going out, you know, is that like 30 degrees, 45? Like how big a piece is pizza? How big a slice?
Yeah, actually.
Are we cutting this pizza into slices of eight or are we cutting it into quads? Well, and then how far out? I guess those are the two only variables in the pizza slice conversation. But
yeah, so to the first one, I think 30 degrees is a pretty good starting point.
Good, yeah.
The problem is if I cast too far upstream, that my flies are actually going to be really close to me, and I'm going to have a lot of slack by the time those flies are dead center in front of me. So if I cast that more out into the river, I'm going to stay a little more true. If I add that stack mend, I'm going to stay true in those seams and those certain sections or grid lines of the river that I want to fish. Now, so I want to keep that pretty tight. Overall length, I don't know. I'd say maybe 15 feet max of a drift.
Okay.
Max. And if you can even keep that tighter, you know, the whole thing is the closer your line is to you, the more control you're going to have over it and the more ability you're going to have to present that properly. If you have a ton of line out there and you're casting on the other side of the river, you may get there, but it's not going to look pretty. You know, it's going to be dragging all over the place. And from what I've seen in a lot of these technical situations, these technical fisheries, is that if you throw a bunch of bad drifts through feeding fish with your nymph, you'll turn them off. It's almost like the same thing that they do when you're dry fly fishing and you smack the top of the water. They'll stop feeding. Mm-hmm. I've seen them do it. So I want to be really tactical and move everything in very small increments.
Okay. You mentioned casting. So how do you find this system meshes with your casting, and how has your casting changed or evolved, or has it? I mean, how do you handle casting with this type of setup, or is it the same?
Yeah. I mean, standard roll cast is just your best friend here. You know, if you're doing a proper roll cast, you can hit those flies in the exact spot you want every single time. I'm a big proponent on 10-foot rods too. So 10-foot rods allow me to kind of cross that barrier into a more of a Euro or straight line setup a little easier too from a static indicator rig. And really I want my nymph rod to be just versatile as could be able to meet any situation with really, without having to change my rigging too much. Oftentimes I'll carry a Euro specific rod, a 11-foot three weight, something like that. But you know, my regular five weight and a 10-foot rod is kind of my Swiss Army knife. I love it for everything. Everything subsurface, you know, if I'm fishing dry flies, I like the 9-footers or even shorter on smaller lengths or smaller weights.
Okay. Before I ask you about hook sets, because I just have to complete the circle in my brain since we're going through kind of all this stuff.
I love it, yeah.
Is there anything that on dead drifting that we haven't talked about that you're like, we can't move on if we don't mention this? Or there, like, I got to talk about this, Jason. Like, I see this all the time, and it's just a, you know, it's a common overthinking it or kind of bad habit or something like that, that you would say. And if there's not, then we can just go straight into hook sets. But I thought I'd ask before I move on without letting you get your final say.
Yeah, that's actually a great question. And I'm a huge proponent of, I'm going to do all I can to get close with my fly selection. And I can get some information here. I can look at any bugs that are hatching and look at their overall general size, coloration, anything like that. I can seine the river. I can see what's in the river and try to match it that way. Now, the fact of the matter is if I have a zebra midge or a black beauty or something like that, and it's in the middle of winter, that's a pretty good bet. I don't really have to get too more complex than that if I don't want to. And what I see a lot of people, the one mistake I see a lot of people make is they'll fish or run and nothing happens, so they change flies. When actually they need to be changing, they need to be focusing on that presentation piece. Are you deep enough? You know, I can't tell you how many times this has happened. It's been a lot where I've been with a customer or a guest, and they're fishing, and I walk up and I move the indicator an inch and a half, 2 inches, something very small, and the next drift, they're hooking fish. So I'm always going to exhaust that first. When I move on or before I even start thinking about changing flies, I want in my head, I want to be 100% sure that I thoroughly fished every single part of that section of river that I set out to fish. that I didn't only fish it, but I fished it effectively. You know, I actually love it because I'll see people on the river go up to a run and they'll spend 2 minutes there and then they move on. And I'm like, oh, right. You know, the South Platte's pretty busy and a lot of people fish it that way. So it's for someone like me, it's not really that big of a deal because people just don't thoroughly fish the river. They don't take the time to get into the spots where they need to be.
What kind of indicators do you prefer?
Oh man, everything, you know, I'm not really, the bobber style ones are probably the easiest to deal with, the airlocks or something like that. I like foam or, I like, not foam, but, yarn sometimes.
Okay.
I don't like yarn too much in the winter cause it freezes and it turns into a block of ice.
yeah, I guess so.
But any indicators that I use, I like to use the smallest ones that they make.
Whatever it is, the overall rule, as small as possible for what I'm doing.
Yeah, and that would depend on where I'm at. You know, if I'm doing static indicator nymphing in Stillwater, I'm going to use the biggest indicator I can find so I can see it through the chop, and it's going to keep up, you know, a 12 or 15 foot long nymph rig, you know. So those smaller, if you're using a lot of weight, you'll have to go up on those indicator sizes, but that's what's nice about it. It's really universal. You can use whatever you want.
Fair enough. Now that you've got this dead drift and it's awesome and you're just right in the seam and right where you want to be, what do you look for? This has been challenging for me, so I'm asking for myself and maybe anybody else, but hook setting, I mean, the hook set itself isn't that mechanically different than what I'm used to, especially nymphing downstream, 45 degree angle kind of thing.
Yep.
But just, knowing when to hook set, you know, like it's not as obvious as, sometimes, it was with like when I was more straight indicator fishing, I guess. So is there other things in this kind of setup that are considerations when you're knowing when to hook set, I guess?
Yeah, and that's a good point too, because to be honest, in the whole scale of things, the majority of the eats are very, very, very subtle. Especially like through the winter, the colder months, this time of year. I mean, they are just subtle. What I like to look for is a distinct lateral movement or a stop or a pause in that indicator. Now, if I'm doing straight line nymphing, I'm going to actually throw a lazy J. I'm going to lead my rod tip just not where I'm dragging my flies, but I want to be just ahead of it. And I can see my leader jump. That's one of the benefits of using that amnesia as well. That gives me almost a sider right almost at my fly line. And I'm going to look for the little tick in that amnesia, and that will allow me to set the hook. The interesting thing about nymphing and indicator nymphing is when you read the disturbance on the indicator, for the most part, the fish has already consumed the fly, determined it's not real, and it's trying to get rid of it. So we're already way behind the curve.
Yeah.
When you're doing a straight line or a Euro type presentation, when you see that line jump is the initial eat. So a lot of times you have a little bit more time, you know, and when I say a little bit more time, it's a fraction of a second for sure, but anything helps, right? So a lot of times when you see that jump in your leader, you can set the hook. And I wholeheartedly agree. I mean, you want to set the hook downriver 100% of the time.
Do you find that I find myself doing this, so I'm interested in your opinions. When I have the lighter take, it seems like I'm less aggressive with my hook set. And I'm not saying that like I need to be going crazy, but I just feel like, is that it? And I just kind of pull and I'm like, I'm just not as aggressive as I am when I see a more aggressive take, you know. And then the extreme example of that is I'm dry fly fishing, which is not nymphing at all, but I'm dry fly fishing. Monster fish comes up, just slams my grasshopper, and I just rip it out because it was so aggressive that I'm going to be aggressive. And you know, that sweet spot in the middle kind of hook set, I feel like it has to be the same regardless. Is that something that you find that is challenging for people when they're, you know, when the takes are so light?
100%. I mean, and that's, I see that too. And I'm probably guilty of that too on some level.
Yeah. It's hard. It's hard to just, what is that? And to just be like, yeah, that's it. And give it what for.
So I like to think about it like this. When I, the hook set's all about the timing. It's not about the power. I had a 12-year-old kid tell me many, many years ago on a guided trip. I was trying to explain the hook set to him, and he looked at me and he goes, "Oh, so more ninja, less professional wrestler." And I said, "Exactly. Yeah." So I use that to this day. And I like to think about it, if I have my my hand out in front of me where I'm holding my rod, yeah. And when I end up in that hook set, I don't really want to go past my side or my body. If I drew a line straight down the river where my body was, I don't want to go back from that. I want to stop right there. It's just a very quick movement. And again, a lot of people will break fish off on that hook set just because it's so violent, and ultimately something's going to give when you get that much tension. And that's where I found that amnesia kind of system on my nymph rig really helps there too, because this amnesia gives me some rebound. So it gives me kind of a little bit of error, margin for error in that hook set. I can set them a little crisper and not have everything's not so rigid down my system where something's going to break.
Okay. That sounds good. I want to shift gears a little bit, John, and talk a little bit about the fly. We talked about presentation and dead drifting.
Yeah.
And I know you said a couple times, you know, that you've put a lot more weight on the presentation, and that was a kind of a light bulb moment for you, as it was for me. I call it being militant. When I got militant about my presentation, when I was like, no, that is unacceptable. It's not, there's no good enough. It has to be like,
you got it.
When I took that approach, that was a game changer for me. But I do think, that I still, you know, I still think about the fly quite a bit. And, but I thought we'd talk about midges, because to me, midges is this like kind of a perfect example of, it's such a simple fly, and they're simple, usually minimal material, minimal time to tie them. And a zebra midge is a great fly. I love the zebra midge, and there's all these variants of the zebra midge. And I know you're a signature fly tire for Umpqua. So the creativity piece is something that I'm sure you think about. So when you're going into a simple fly like this, what are the things that you bring to the table that are going to, that you think, you know, the light bulb moment, I was reading, you know, I was laying in bed and I had an idea and I tied it and went out and fished it. And that's something that is important to you and that you like about fly fishing. How do you see that unfolding with midges?
Yeah. So,
does that make sense? Is that a valid question?
Yeah,
I'm just wondering, like, how do you take that creativity in such a simple fly?
Yeah, so I think, you know, and that's midges, and everyone says just midges, you know, it's
just, just midges, yeah. Right.
The fact of the matter is that's the constant food source for trout everywhere. Stillwater, lakes, rivers, streams.
Right.
There are midges available 365 days a year. So it's kind of like the ramen noodles of the sea, so to speak.
Exactly. So if you were going to go into the weeds on a fly, the midge would be like a good one to go into.
Yeah.
Even though it's just a midge.
Yeah. And I tie a lot of different patterns. One of my signature patterns with Umpqua, the blindside midge, was just something that I developed a very long time ago in an effort to kind of crack some of those really technical tailwater fish that were notorious for getting out of the way of your drift. I wanted something to get their attention. So I took some very key, you know, I got in the weeds thinking about this.
Yeah, and all right.
Watched entomology videos, and I like to think of myself of having a pretty good entomology understanding. I used to work with a guy, Robert Younghans. He's known throughout the industry as the bug guy. So he's a total nerd with entomology, and he really taught me a ton, and changed the way I look at fly fishing, the way I look at fly tying and everything. I think a lot of it is you know, giving the fish something different. So one of the things that I set out with the blindside midge was some key attributes of a pupating midge. Now, I'm 100% convinced that fish love the action stages of these insects. When you're talking midges, mayflies, and caddisflies, they love that emergent stage, that transitional stage where that bug can't do anything. It can't swim anymore. It is just at the mercy of trying to get to the surface of the water, and it's being carried down by the current. I think the more vulnerable something is, the more the trout's spidey senses kind of turn on, and they have to eat it. They don't want to eat it. They have to. So the design of the blindside midge is that pupating stage of that midge. So it's got a kind of a soft hackle type material, ostrich hurl, which undulates really well under the water. It kind of breathes. So no matter which cross current it's hitting, it's going to have a lot of action. And then I have a little bit of pink eye stub behind that for the thorax that kind of imitates that, you know, all the gases and stuff that develop in these bugs when they are emerging. They turn some really dynamic colors. So
the gases do, like the bubbles, yeah, that they're going to ride up. Those are different colors and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And they have a bunch of hemoglobin in their bodies. So they can be just all these different dynamic colors. I mean, I've seen I've seen midges in every color under the rainbow. You'll see some really kind of cool blues and purples in the spring. I mean, obviously red is just a great color, olive, cream, white, black, brown, every color you could ever imagine, can incorporate into that midge. So again, what I'm always looking for is to try to give them something a little bit different than they're seeing. If I'm looking on the river and there's 1,000 people fishing zebra midges and I throw something a little bit different, but it still looks right.
It still looks right. How much of it is that, do you think? How much of it is like on a river like the South Platte, they just see 100 zebra midges, so this one is, the Black Beauty is a little different, you know? It's got that little fluoro tail thing, and this bead head is just a little different or something like that.
Yeah, and it's just the slight tweaks, right? It's you know, Pat Dorsey has a bunch of those patterns, the Mercury midge, the Black Beauty, that are just kind of the basis for a lot of midge patterns out there, right? And I think if you can tie your own flair on there, whether it's adding a little bit of flash behind the bead or no bead or different materials in the body or all that kind of stuff, you know, that's the unique thing about being not only an angler but a fly tier. Is that I could add my own twist. If I seine the river and I see something in that seine that I haven't really seen before, then I can imitate that and try to create a pattern that's actually going to crack the code of what I am seeing on the river. So that's the fun part about it. I mean, I tell people fly fishing is super fun, and really it can get more fun. But when you start effectively imitating what's in the river and then you start catching fish on your flies, that's a whole other deal. Like that's a whole other door that opens. And I have a pretty crazy process with my flies. Like I don't just tie something up at the bench and call it good. You know, the blindside midge was R&D'd for over 20 years.
That's more than just tying something up.
Yeah. That's probably a little long, but, you know, I have some other patterns that sit in a fly box that I've been fishing for, you know, 2 or 3 years now. And when I have 100% confidence, then I'll try to expose them to the world. But, for now I want to do more research and dial them in. And, that's the fun part.
The thing that's cool about the blindside midge that I noticed immediately is that collar. And, you know, I like that movement. I like that there's something, especially with emerger type flies or flies that are coming up from the bottom, that there's something that either imitates the bubble or gives it motion, or, you know, I would agree that even if it's just at that part of the drift where it's swinging up, that motion is important. And if you could tie something on the fly that complements that, I guess that would be the, that's something that I think about. I don't think about fly tying as in depth as what you're describing, but I do think about that more. And I do start to tie, especially with those emergers, a little bit more stuff onto them that, that gives them that, but not too much. You got like one thing in my brain when I do it, you got like one extra thing. If you do too much, then it's crazy. Although, you know, I would almost always fish a guide's choice hare's ear over a regular hare's ear. And why is that? I catch more fish with it and it's kind of the same critter, but it's that collar. I think it's just that collar gives it the motion, and I always do better with it, but that could just be, I mean, that is anecdotal, but that is my experience.
Well, and it's cool too, because if you look at one of the most iconic fly patterns out there, just a soft tackle, right? I mean, it's been nailing fish all over the world for 100 and some odd years, right? And
yeah, why is that?
Yeah, and I think exactly. So Angler's Covey, we do this thing called Bug of the Month, and so we always pick on something each month. It's kind of our educational thing, our spin on that. And this month we did soft tackles, and we had a ball doing it. We had a ball tying them, just traditional soft tackles. And I had an absolute ball fishing them, right? Like, so something as simple as that, like when you look at an industry that has gone kind of primarily to all these synthetic materials and glues, UV resin on everything. And I really believe that if that's the majority of what's being fished in a river, the fish are going to kind of come off that eventually. They're going to start looking for something a little bit different. And I've seen it my whole life on the South Platte. We'll have, you know, 2 years of where a particular fly pattern is just doing serious work, and then all of a sudden it's not so effective anymore. And then two or three years later, you revisit that, and it kind of ebbs and flows, you know. So having a bunch of different types of flies in a bunch of different sizes and colors is really kind of all I'm ever going for. I really want to effectively imitate anything that's in the water. So if you look at that, we'll go back to just a midge, right? Like I could fish midge larva. I could fish really small soft tackles or something that has movement and imitate that pupating stage of that midge. And if I'm doing that and I have some variety in sizes and colors and all that kind of stuff in those two categories, then I'm going to be pretty much able to catch fish. I'm going to have effective patterns.
When do you make a decision to, because you have this straight line set up, when do you make a decision to come out of that bottom area and fish more mid column? Like when is that, what triggers you to do that? Or if you do that at all?
Yeah. So, one of the things, and you know, I'm always going to be looking for bugs. If I'm seeing midges or blooming anything, if I'm seeing anything flying around on the water and I'm seeing little to no surface activity, I know those fish are eating those bugs as they're emerging. And that's where I'll really, like, one of my favorite things to do and teach is actually sight fishing. That's kind of my drug.
Oh, we should have talked about sight fishing next time.
Yeah, we'll tie some of that in. But really what I like to do there is, you know, if I'm seeing bugs flying around, they're on me, but I'm not seeing any action on the surface, that's when I really start peering into the river. And sometimes I'll take a total break and set my fly rod down and just look. I'm going to go to those places like right in the head of a run or something like that, and I'm going to see if I can see fish moving into different water to feed. When trout are aggressively feeding, they will move into shallower, faster water to do that, because that's where the majority of the food is actually starting out. So if I start seeing that, even fish behavior, right? If I start seeing that, then I know those fish are going to be eating that emerger stage of that insect. If I have the ability to sight fish and I can see where those fish are in the water column, that's when I can really make the decision to switch to a different part of the water column. Or that's one of the benefits of that bottom weighted drop shot rig, with my tags, because those tags are actually going to be in different parts of that mid column. So that's a technique that I could just go to. So there's several different factors that I'll look at when I try to make that decision.
All right. The South Platte. I want to ask you a few questions before we move on about the South Platte. You talked about sight fishing, so we can talk a little bit about sight fishing in here, but the South Platte being a technical tailwater, like we've mentioned, it's also a great sight fishing river. And to me, that's at first, that was like the bane of my existence. Like there's all these fish. I can see them. I can't catch them. Like that was, but as I've kind of grown now, I appreciate that a lot more because it becomes a benefit because you can see what's working and what's not working. And if you're paying attention, it can expedite the learning process. If you're going out there and you're trying to figure things out, which many of our listeners, you know, those are the types of folks that listen to the show, or they're trying to progress and get better.
Yeah.
That sight fishing is a great way to do it because you can see fish feeding, how they fish, and why you can see almost why they're not taking your fly. So I guess my question to you with that kind of backdrop is, sight fishing is something that you enjoy. If you could only fish the South Platte 2 days of the year, which 2 days would you fish and how would you fish it? Or if you could only go sight fishing, if you're going out to sight fish, or when would you go do that?
Well, you can do it year round, which is nice. To pick two times, man, that's
your tough. Favorite times. Doesn't have to be like the best fishing. That's not what I'm asking. Just like, your favorites?
I love the beginning of spring when we're seeing maybe some blueing olives enter the equation. Fish, trout love to eat mayflies no matter where you live. So when we come out of winter and there's new food, I think they get a little bit more excited. Their metabolism's changing a little bit. There's new food offerings and they can, they're going to start feeding really aggressively. So, you know, even through winter, man, I love sight fishing in the winter. To pick two times is really hard. I'd probably say spring, winter and spring. I'll just say that.
all right. There's no rules. So that works. Winter and spring. Those aren't very specific, but it doesn't have to be specific.
I like summer and fall too. Yeah. That's
and how are you? Those are also good times.
Yeah.
No, that's fine. Let's say we talked a lot about midges and tying. If I was going to come out there and fish with you, what are a couple simple flies that I, as a slightly below average fly tire that I could tie, that you would say, okay, yeah, we can use these for, we can fish these a little bit. So just a few materials, simple. What would you recommend? Kind of confidence flies.
Well, yeah, for midges, my blind side's my confidence fly. Absolutely. And it's really easy to tie. There's several tutorials floating around out there on how to tie it. So it's not hard by any means. It's a total guide fly. It's easy to fly, easy to tie. It's super effective. And those are the two things that I really look for in any fly that I tie. You know, if you wanted to go into the betas category, a simple pheasant tail is really hard to beat. You know, okay. Or any variation, a million different variations of that are out there right now. Really, really kind of hard to beat. Again, when I'm sight fishing, I like to really kind of focus on that action stage, the emergent stage of whatever bug I'm targeting. I think the fish are more inclined to eat something like that than just maybe a dead drifted larva. Not saying don't do it. It just, and I'm not saying it wouldn't work. It's just, I think when I'm sight fishing, I'm looking at a feeding fish. And a feeding fish will tell you when it's feeding. If you ever see a fish, sit there, don't cast to it, watch it. And the interesting thing here is I always want to go up to where the head shape is. And just to make it easy for everybody, if you think you see a fish, you're never really going to see the whole fish. So I always look for a piece of it. I look for the tail or the fins even, or I look for movement. I look for a longer kind of oblong shape that's moving, that's definitely a fish. And then when I actually see that, I'm going to look at the head, which is always going to be at the upstream part. And I'm going to stare very intently at the head. And what I'm looking for is I want to see little flashes of white. If I'm seeing flashes of white, that's its mouth opening. I know that's a feeding fish. And where the benefit of this comes in, and for the angler, it can really, like you said, really ramp up the progression, is I'm not arbitrarily fishing a run now. I have a target. I can focus on exact depth, weight, wherever that fish is. And you'll know when you have a good drift because lo and behold, the fish will eat it. When they're actively feeding like that, they're going to be less inclined to investigate things too much, and because there's a lot of food moving by them. My job as the angler is I want to camouflage my offering right into the mix of everything else. So it's really rapid. And when you start catching fish, when you're sight fishing, it's a whole other door that opens. It's a confidence booster for the angler. And that's where you really start to figure out how important my drift is, where my flies are, and all those technical elements that we've just been talking about.
One of the things that I hear you say a lot in kind of your social media feed and some of the other things is no bad days, no bad days on the river, no bad days when you're out there. And it's obvious that you love what you do. I know that we talked before the show and you had mentioned your sobriety is something that's important to you, 20 years sober, and that's no small feat. I'm curious, how has fly fishing kind of tied into that process for you? Was there a time when fly fishing was in jeopardy, or either in jeopardy or kind of part of the healing process, or part of the, kind of what set you down that road of sobriety? And I guess maybe a better way of asking that is, why is it important for you to kind of be part of organizations like Reeling and Serenity and bringing that message to people in the fly fishing community?
Well, yeah. And those are great questions. You know, I'm not quite 20 years sober. I'll be 20 years sober in July, but 19, it's still a very long time. So the interesting thing with that is, and just to kind of set this up, not everybody is an alcoholic. Not everybody is a drug addict. There's a difference between people like me and a lot of people I know, where we have a physiological reaction to things like that, that can really be detrimental to our existence. So for me, you know, the gift of going through a lot of hard times and having people there to help me when I asked a question or asked the right question was absolutely instrumental. So first and foremost, I never mind talking about this because someone could be listening to this podcast and they're struggling with addiction and they don't really know what to do next. They feel alone. That's a common thread between all of us, is that we feel like we're the only ones that are going through something like that. The revelation is you're not alone and there is a solution. You know, and the great fact for me is that I really became convinced that I never had to drink again. And, for someone like me that couldn't imagine life with it or without it, that's a pretty big feat. So what that stole from me, during all that active addiction was it stole all my passions. And when I got sober, all my passions were reignited, like tenfold, right? And I started to really see the importance of mental health as I've gone on through life. And I'm a father and a husband, and, you know, I'm raising kids in this crazy day and age, and mental health is just such a huge piece of everything that we need to be dealing with right now. Not only for my own serenity, but everybody else's. You know, we need to be able to connect to something outside of ourselves. And that really is kind of what fly fishing, has brought me and a greater understanding of, You know, when I'm fishing with folks, I tell them when you hook a fish, the first thing you want to do after you hook that fish is take a deep breath and look around. Like, you're not in a hurry to do anything right now. Look where you are. Really, really recognize the whole package, right? I like to think about that in terms of how I work in, within the fly fishing industry too. It's not about going out there and hammering 100 fish. It's about the whole experience. And I can tell you, man, I've had some amazing days where maybe I didn't even catch a fish, but it was just my mindset. It was what the river gave me in terms of just some relief, a deep breath, something like that. So I think it's an inherent and easy connection. If I go to the river to seek solitude and to seek peace, I'm naturally going to have a successful day. And it has nothing to do with the fish. The fish are an added bonus. If I get to fish, that's great. Sometimes I'll go out just to sight fish and it's a really slow day and maybe I'll cast my rod for 5 minutes during the day. And it was just an awesome day. I feel fulfilled, right? So that was a mouthful there for sure. But for me personally, that's been a release. That's been my church. One of my favorite quotes in fly fishing is, you know, I went fishing my whole life without realizing it wasn't the fish I was after. And that really speaks to kind of what I was just talking about.
Were you fly fishing before you got sober?
Yeah, yes, but yeah, I was doing a lot of things before I got sober.
Were you guiding back then too?
No, I was not.
So do you find that, that transition for you was, I guess you said it, but that transition for you must have been a reintroduction, I guess, into something that you were passionate about, it sounds like.
100%. Yeah. Like my progression, when I first started up until really I got sober was very slow. It was very slow because I didn't devote any time or energy to it. I was devoting all my time and my energy to alcohol. And that wasn't really a choice at that point. It was just all I knew how to do. I was just trying to manage every day the best I could. And that those days turned into years and those years turned into a decade, you know, so it happened very quickly.
Did you find that fly fishing helped you in sobriety?
Yeah, it helps me today, man. I mean, like I said, when we were talking before, you know, it's been a long time since I've thought about drinking. It's not really a problem for me anymore, but I still have the mental aspect of being an addict or an alcoholic, and my brain is still alcoholic. And, you know, so I need to do things to mitigate that. The one thing I love about fly fishing is when I do it, I'm all in. There's no room in my brain or even in my life for anything else to creep in. I don't think about what I didn't do yesterday or what I need to do tomorrow. I am truly present. And in this day and age, being present is a very, very hard thing to do. You know, we're receiving information at a higher rate than we ever have. You know, I mean, it's proof. Any of you that are on social media, you know, you just
any
scrolling.
Of you are you on social media?
Of course I am. Any of okay. us?
Any of us? All right.
But I'll find myself doing that as I'm just endlessly scrolling through social media, looking at dumb videos, and it's just my brain is completely immersed into it. Right. So
no, I hate when I do that. I mean, it makes me feel so terrible. It doesn't happen a ton, but when it does, I'm like, dude, exactly, what are you doing, dude? Talk to me about reeling in serenity and how that kind of became part of your life and why it's important for you.
Yeah, Reeling in Serenity is a great organization. It's relatively new. It's small. It is all over the country. And I joined the board in January and it was asked by a mutual friend within the fly fishing industry that that is also involved with that organization. And Reeling in Serenity is an organization that celebrates, you know, sobriety, and it's a safe place for people that are sober or trying to get sober, circled in fly fishing. You know, if you look at or watch any videos that are out there with the film tours or anything like that, alcohol and a lot of drugs are a central part of all that. Like you see, you know, at the end of the day, you're sitting at your truck and you got to crack the beer, and it's like a ritual. So, you know, a lot of people that are in fly fishing don't feel like there's a safe place for them to be, because, you know, that's the visual of it.
Well, it's tough. I mean, I don't know what it's like in any way to go through those types of things that you're talking about, but I do know that if you're trying to break a bad habit and you're surrounded by people or doing something, it can make it more difficult. Which it sounds like is what you're kind of getting at. Like, hey, you know, like, so it might be, if somebody was struggling, it might be easier for them to go fishing with somebody who's not going to, I don't know, they're just not in that environment. Like if you're going to bars all the time because that's what you do with your friends, it's harder to not drink. Again, totally.
No,
I'm not an expert. I mean, I'm just saying, like, this is my observation. It seems like that to have somebody to go fishing with, that, you know, that's not going to come up, that's not going to be an issue, even just that would be nice, maybe.
100%. And if you look at all these awesome movements that are happening throughout fly fishing, they're everywhere. There's a ton of them. There's women's only stuff. It's all the same. They're trying to get like-minded or similar folks together to create safe spaces. And that's what Reeling is in Serenity is for, you know, for addicts and alcoholics in recovery. It's one of those places. And, you know, there's so much taboo that surrounds addiction and so much that people don't understand about it. You know, and I can unequivocally say this, everybody that I know in recovery are just some of the most dynamic and amazing individuals I've ever met in my life. It really doesn't get as any more complex than some people are just different and have a different reaction to those things, than other people. And, you know, I'm not bound by this either. I can go out and I have friends that drink. I have friends that get drunk. For me, I just don't care. I don't care if they can do that. Good for them. It's not an issue for me anymore. But I'm not everybody either, right? There's people that are newer in recovery or they're white knuckling it, that don't have the ability or the gift, I guess it's because it is a gift. It's nothing I did. I look at my sobriety as 110% grace. And it's something that I really don't want to ever compromise. Right. So there's things that I need to do as a human being to stay on top of that. And, you know, something like fly fishing or just being outside is my pill. That's my medicine to be able to do that. I need to be able to unplug and connect to nature and connect to my roots and do all of that. That is 100% my medication for life on life's terms.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that. And hopefully somebody that is listening, maybe if they're having issues, they could reach out to some of these organizations or realize that there's other people that can help them. Like you
100%,
said,
100%. Yep.
And that they can kind of continue down that road, getting healthy if they need help. John, before I ask you my last question, how can people find out more about you? Some of the other flies that we didn't mention, or where can they find some of those and maybe schedule a guided trip? And then also anything that you are just excited about coming up in the future that you want to let people know about?
Yeah, no, I really appreciate it. And, I always feel bad after I talk in a class or I'm guiding or I'm on a podcast. I feel like I just kind of machine gun a lot of information out there. So first and foremost, I'm always available for anybody that ever wants to message me and ask me any questions from fly fishing to fly patterns to even sobriety. I'm a pretty open book. I'm on Instagram. My Instagram is hookset_flyfishing. You can direct message me through there. I'm pretty responsive through that. I can see that right away. As you mentioned, I am a signature fly tire with Umpqua Feather Merchants. I have two patterns currently out with them, the Blindside Midge, which we talked about, and then another pattern called the Slapshot Scud. And this is a inverted scud pattern, kind of the only one on the market. And another pattern that I developed after some serious R&D and seeing the just gross amount of scuds that are in the South Platte River and a lot of the stillwater fisheries that I fish, and then trying to just make something a little bit different that would again crack the code. And I definitely believe I've done that with that fly. It's been a staple for me and a lot of guides. So this is the first year they've been out. You can find both those patterns at any Umpqua dealer. If your dealer does not carry them, they need to. I guarantee no matter where you live, they will find a special place in your fly box. You can always call Angler's Covey too, and we'd be happy to do any sort of order over the phone or send them to you, anything like that. You can also contact me directly and I'll spin you up some custom ones. So, it's kind of that part of the year where we're gearing up for the season. I'm always busy. So as we start to get to this part of the season, it had all the prep for the winter starts to come into play, all the flies that I've tied. And, we're looking really good for water this year, in our area. And if anybody out there has never been to the Colorado Springs area, the South Platte River, the Arkansas Tailwater, I want to urge you to definitely come check it out. It is a bucket list place for a fly fisher. It's a really easy place to travel here, really inexpensive. But like you said, you grew up fishing here. It's technical. You want to learn some of that technical water. You know, we have a lot of guides that are more than qualified to show you the ropes. So,
yeah, I think I wrote a blog post called small flies, tough hook sets, and light takes. It's good for you.
It's good.
It's like eat your vegetables because it's good for you.
You got it. Yeah.
All right.
Well, and just to actually piggyback on that, the cool thing about that, and you alluded to this as well, is when you learn how to fish technical water, you can take those techniques anywhere in the world. And what technical water does is it makes you pay attention to the very important things when you're fishing. So when you start to learn and adopt that, it makes you a better angler overall. It's made me a better saltwater angler, actually. Every piece of fly fishing that I've done, it's made me better by fishing technical water. So I want to throw that out there. It's not like if you live in a place where you don't think it's technical, take a technical mindset to it and you will have more success.
I think that's well said. Last question. You ready?
Yes, sir.
If you could go back to when you first started fly fishing and give yourself two pieces of advice, one more tactical, one more philosophical, what would you tell yourself to help you progress as a fly fisher?
Tactical. Pay attention to the detail. It's not about catching the fish.
Okay.
It's not about catching the fish. Catching the fish is a result of paying attention to the detail. So I have to start paying attention to the detail before I can catch the fish. So that would be my main thing. I think a lot of new anglers are kind of jaded by that. They want to catch a fish, and I get that. But you got to start at the beginning. Philosophical, I think that, that phrase that I just love, I've been going fishing my whole life without realizing it's not the fish that I'm after. Really appreciating the fact that I am where I'm at that given moment. And it doesn't really matter if it's an urban creek or anything. I'm outside, I'm on the river, I'm connected to that resource. Looking at it for what it truly is an absolute gift. I don't take any day for granted. And that's why I say there's no bad days on the water.
No bad days. I love it, John. Thank you. That's a great way to end it. And I really appreciate all the knowledge you shared, about presentation and the midges, and especially, your sobriety. And I know that takes courage, and I know that people are listening, that you're going to be able to help with that message as well. So, thanks for being vulnerable and talking about that. And thanks for being on the show. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. I love getting in the weeds on a lot of the tactics stuff, as you could tell, hopefully. And, it was just a joy to talk to you today. So thanks for being on the show.
Jason, thank you, my man. I mean, it was my pleasure. And I always love talking about fly fishing to anybody. And, you know, I hope that our paths cross sometime and that we can get out and share a couple lines on the river.
Thanks for listening to the Wade Out There Fly Fishing Podcast. You can learn more about some of the topics we discussed in today's episode show notes. For more fly fishing ideas, stories, and artwork, check out my blog and online gallery at wadeoutthere.com. If you want to make Wade Out There a part of your own fly fishing journey, please subscribe and share. Until next time, Wade Out There.